This Be Podcast Network show is presented by IXL. Loved and trusted by more than 1 million teachers, IXL enhances your teaching and takes work off your plate, so you can make an even bigger impact on your students. IXL delivers personalized learning across a comprehensive pre-K through 12th grade curriculum, including math, language arts, science, and social studies, and helps you assess student performance through actionable real-time insights. Strengthen daily instruction, close knowledge gaps quickly, and set every student up for success. If you want to bring IXL to your school, you can learn more at IXL.com/BE. That's IXL.com/BE. This is Dr. Karen, and you're listening to the De Facto Leaders Podcast on the Be Podcast Network, where I share up-to-date, evidence-based practices, my own experience, and guest interviews designed to help pediatric therapists, educators, and aspiring school leaders design services that support social, emotional, and academic growth and set kids up for success in adulthood. Whether you want to learn effective strategies for your therapy session or classroom, be an influential leader on your team, or find creative ways to use your skills to advance in your career, I've got you covered. Hey there, it's Dr. Karen, and welcome to episode 157 of the De Facto Leaders Podcast on the Be Podcast Network. The literacy space has become increasingly polarizing since the reading wars began. There are a number of debates and questions that continue, including, will kids learn to read naturally? What did the whole language approach get right, if anything? Is explicit phonics instruction just a pendulum swing? And is focusing on phonics enough? Are we teaching kids to read too early? And when we talk about early literacy instruction, what are we actually recommending and how does that look? I invited Jane Giebers, veteran speech-language pathologist and author, to episode 157 of De Facto Leaders to discuss these questions. I entered the field around the time the National Reading Panel study was published, so there was a fair amount of research on evidence-based literacy intervention when I started practicing. But when Jane started practicing, much of this research hadn't been done, and she had the experience of watching the fields of education and reading instruction evolve. She was also one of the early adopters of many approaches that are common practice today, and it was an honor to hear about her work and talk with her. Jane is the author of the popular resource Books Are for Talking To, first published in 1990 and now in its fourth edition as of March 2023. A practicing speech-language pathologist for over 40 years, she has worked in public school, hospital, private, and clinical settings. She has been an adjunct professor at St. Mary's College of California and other universities where she taught language development, assessment, and intervention courses to students pursuing special education credentials. She currently holds a private practice in Northern California. In this conversation, Jane and I discuss a number of topics relating to early literacy, including things like scaffolding. Everyone's talking about scaffolding and why we should be doing it, but what does this word actually mean? Reading practices that have stood the test of time, despite many efforts to disprove their effectiveness. The battle between play-based learning and sight words, and how to emphasize the right skills at the right time. When building language skills, do we focus on a developmental hierarchy or environmental demands? Or a little bit of both. Mapping language to print symbols and what to address in the early years to set the stage for reading and spelling. We really tease out the nuance in this topic and clarify some of the terms. And both of us really came to the conclusion that many times when people are debating when we should work on reading, how we should be working on it, and when we should start working on reading, we're actually closer to agreement than we realize. It's just that the discussions get so convoluted in the way that we communicate. So We teased out a lot of these questions in the conversation. Before I get going, I wanted to mention Language Therapy Advanced Foundations, my program that helps SLPs create a system for language therapy. Because Jane addresses some of the questions around early literacy, I thought this conversation would be a nice supplement to some of the tools that I share in Language Therapy Advanced Foundations, where I really provide a framework for supporting the language skills that are going to be beneficial in the school age years. You can learn more about the program at drkarenspeech.com/language therapy. We also talk a lot about play and inferencing in this conversation, which supports executive functioning, which is also extremely important. And I share a framework for supporting executive functioning in the School of Clinical Leadership, both what you need to do in direct intervention sessions, as well as how you can lead your team and ensuring these supports are in place across the day. To learn more about that program, you can go to drkarendudekbrennan.com/clinical leadership. Now, please enjoy this conversation with Jane Giebers. Today, I am joined by Jane Giebers, an author and speech pathologist. So thank you so much for being here with me today.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
So I am so excited to talk with you. As I said before, I wanted to start recording as soon as possible because we just, in our last conversation, I wish I had recorded that. So I thought we could start off by having you share a little bit about yourself and then we can get into the conversation.
I would love to. So I am a practicing speech pathologist. I started speech therapy in 1975. And during the course of my work in hospitals, clinics, and schools, I really wanted to share with my fellow speech pathologists the importance of contextualized therapy in terms of picture books for children. And so long before the research was out, I was fortunate to publish a book called Books Are for Talking To. And it was a resource for, at that point, speech pathologists. Now it's, you know, for really anybody who's interested, but it was for speech pathologists to encourage them, if you can imagine, to use picture books in speech therapy. And of course, we all really needed it. There was such a thing as collaboration during that time. And then, you know, when the research came out later on about the importance of speech and language and phonological awareness in the emergent literacy area, then, you know, the book was revised again and it's revised again. So that's pretty much what my area of focus has been.
Well, I remember as we were talking before, you just shared, I came into the field when a lot of this research was out. I was in the schools when the National Reading Panel study was published. So that's when I was just first getting in and starting to practice. And I still felt like I was overwhelmed as someone going into the schools and figuring out not just my role, but what everyone else's role was in literacy and how it should look across the grade levels from preschool all the way through high school and beyond. Uh-huh. And what I thought was really interesting is that you have seen this whole progression of the research and you've exactly observed it in action more so than a lot of people that I've talked to. So I would love to know what that was like for you. And I think in the course of you telling that story, we can probably just talk about the history and just the impact of language and reading and where we can help kids.
Well, I can tell you that very early when I started the book, Books Are for Talking Too, it was in the 80s. And when Communication Skill Builders wanted to publish it, they said, well, where's the rest of your research? Mm. And I said, well, there isn't any. And so the research that was out there was done by a woman I call a living legend. And she's Dr. Carol Wesby. I'm sure many people have heard of her. And she'd written a chapter in a book called Learning to Talk, Talking to Learn. Or that was her chapter, rather. It's Oral Literate Language Differences. And she published it in 1985. And here's what she wrote. I've got this quote. She says, although stories may be read without interruption, which is what we did back then, at other times, there is discussion between the reader and listeners about what's happening in the stories, how this information is to be interpreted, and the related experiences the children have had. So all that was so meaningful to me in that, first of all, she was out there doing her research. And she was just a front runner in all of this. And so I grabbed onto that research and used it. And it wasn't long after that that this whole language approach came along.
Yeah.
And, you know, unfortunately, it really is unfortunate that this was just so frowned upon when the good research came out about the studies concluded in 1997 by the prevention of reading difficulties in young children, that, you know, that phonological awareness piece was so huge in reading that we just kind of threw out that whole language when it was only a piece of that importance of laying the foundations for emergent literacy. It was such an important piece. And yet, you know, the underlying foundations, which is really the sound system of language, the phonological aspect, applying those sounds to letters, that was missing in that. And so then as a result, when the new research came out from the, as I said, the prevention of reading difficulties in young children, which was the funded by the National Institution of Health, I believe, Department of Health. Well, that's, I love the fact that that research just stands. And that is that the underpinnings of emergent literacy begin with sound production, the phonological piece, the applying sounds to the letters or to words. I read a wonderful article of in the Iowa Reading Research Center website. It was the Neuroscience of Reading with Dr. G. Reed Lyon. They've looked at this over and over and over. And he says, my job as a researcher is to see if I can falsify the hypothesis. So in other words, they're looking to debunk this theory that you need to have a basis in phonological awareness and language, the basic, you know, developing language skills, vocabulary and background information. And he said there isn't anything that they can do to debunk it. It's just there. There's no matter what they try and do, that is a solid research that is not going to go away with new technology, yeah. New understanding of the brain, nothing. That just stands.
What were you saying about, you said something was discouraged, or which one were you talking about, phonological awareness?
I'm talking about the whole language movement and what a tragedy it was that they had to just frown on it and throw it out because the pieces of language were so important. It's just that they were missing the phonological awareness aspect of it, the basis of sound. And so what happened is reading programs just went to whole language and they missed this, the entire foundation of literacy, emergent literacy. You know, it was just so unfortunate to me because that's an important skill, but so is the rest of language, the components of language. So the rest of the components of language, vocabulary and morphosyntax structures.
Mm-hmm.
So what he said in this beautiful interview, he was interviewed, it was the Q&A blog post. It's a maybe a podcast series, but he's such a honored, distinguished leading researcher in the field of neuroscience. And he gave a wonderful background of how he got into this, but I loved this part. And he said, the job of the scientist is to falsify the hypothesis. And what he said they tried to do for the last 20 years is to try and falsify the fact that you need instruction to be direct, explicit, and systematic. And he said, but we could not overturn that.
That's interesting.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And he said, those factors just won't go away. If you over and over, he said, to produce better results in student reading achievement, you have to have the phonology, the sound symbol association, the syllables, the morphosyntactic structures, the syntax, the semantics. And I loved it. I loved the fact that we can really hang our hat on it.
Mm-hmm. I don't think people realize that the idea of falsifying something, that it seems like it's the other way around, where typically when you design a research study, it's, I have this hypothesis and I'm trying to prove that it's true, which is part of it. But the idea that no matter what, it's not a pendulum swing. It's just, this is what we know.
And
I think it's interesting because it sounds like there was a little bit of swinging where we know that there's more to reading than phonics. We know that we need those language components, but with whole language, it's almost like we did swing too far where it's, we need this language, but wait, we can't forget about this other
component
here. I know you had mentioned some other things. We talked about some of the front runners with this research, such as Carol Westby and Reed Lyon. And I know that Pamela Snow is another one who was really influential. And so I'm curious if you followed her work as well throughout this process.
Well, Pamela Snow was the lead researcher in the study they did and published in 1998, the National Research Council. And it was the Committee on Preventing Reading Difficulties in Young Children. And her work, as Reed Lyon said in his interview, that work still stands.
Mm-hmm.
It's still solid. So I'm just a fan of hers because she wasn't just the lead researcher on this. She didn't just fade away. She continued to promote this research and show us what it means to have direct, explicit, systematic instruction. What does it mean? And so she continues to be out there explaining this concept, which needs to be explained, because when you use these terms to educators, then we need to know what that translates to. Yes, we need direct instruction. That means direct with the child. So, and we need explicit. We need to give them definitions and examples, and then systematic. And in Books Are for Talking Too, which is of course my book, I've got a whole program for using children's picture books in phonological awareness activities. And it goes the entire spectrum of phonological activities. So it starts with listening skills, and then it goes to word awareness level. And then it goes to initial sound awareness level, rhyming awareness level, and syllable. And those are all just the beginning stages of phonological awareness. And then, you know, there's the advanced phonemic awareness levels, which, you know, people are always getting those terms mixed up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, can they give you final sound? Do they have final sound awareness, middle sound of a word? Can they synthesize, you know, the onset rhyme? Can they synthesize the words, and can they analyze, you know, what sounds are in a word? And then can they manipulate? And it's all so systematic, and it's all built on these levels, if you will. Mm-hmm. So the research shows you just don't start at one level, depending on where the child, what age the child is. You start at where the child can perform easily and then move from there. And so where are they on that continuum is where you need to build the skills, start to build those skills. And I've got a whole section devoted to that in Books Are for Talking To, using well-known familiar books. Some of them come in sets. You can get them at Costco. You know, they're the, if you give a mouse a cookie set, and the Karma Wilson Bear Snores On for the little ones. And they come in, you know, easy sets to buy. And you can just work up the ladder, if you will, to those skills that kids need in order to lay that foundation for emergent literacy. Mm-hmm. So, and they can be fun. They can be fun activities. You can, you know, just have, I've labeled them all, in fact, with little names so that they're fun to use, like add it on and all sorts of, you know, mix it up and switch it and you know, just so that they can feel like it's a game. So, you know, let's say the sound and let's play odd one out, which is, you know, which one, give them a string of words and say which one, you know, doesn't rhyme or which one doesn't have the same middle sound. So I guess what I'm saying is that systematic really does mean systematic. It means starting from, you know, step one and step two and step three. It isn't grade level material. It's just where the child is, where that preschool, kindergarten child is, and then, you know, building from there.
That's one of the things that is, it's tricky because you have to have this balance between considering the environmental expectations, which is what we have to do as we go through school and life, but also be developmental enough that we can be systematic, because some language skills, when you get to the school age years, that whole progression of language development, it doesn't follow this linear pattern like in the early years. And then it's very difficult to say this is developmentally appropriate at this age. You almost have to look at what have they been exposed to and what skills are going to have the biggest impact on comprehension. And so that whole idea of being systematic tend to look different as you get older. And I think that that's where it just gets confusing, because in the context that you described, it's appropriate to work up a hierarchy, but then for other language skills, it gets very difficult and it doesn't necessarily benefit you to do that. I always have people who ask me what vocabulary words are age appropriate for.
Oh yeah.
Well, that's really hard to pinpoint, because where are they from? What has their environmental experience been like? You know, I had a student who his dad owned a car dealership. And I remember that one of the questions on the language screening was, what do you do with a car? And the answer that you were supposed to give was, you drive it. And he said, you sell it. And that wasn't an answer on the thing.
But to him, yes.
And it made sense.
Of course, background knowledge. Yeah.
But I was working in this town where kids knew what sprayers and combines and tractors were. But if I would have gone to another town, maybe up in 2 hours north, up in Chicago, they wouldn't have been as familiar with that vocabulary. It would have been something else. So when you're talking about being systematic, it gets different. And so I'm curious if you have seen this as well. I know that we've discussed this a little bit, where there's this almost this debate on what do we do for those younger students, those preschool, kindergarten, what should school look like for them? And I think that things get lost in translation because of what you just said about there's these terms and maybe we're not all defining them the same, or we don't have a clear picture of what they mean. So for example, one way that I've seen it play out is that people will compare the US to other countries. And when we start teaching reading, and some people are concerned that we are, and I'm using air quotes here, teaching reading or working on literacy too early. And at the same time, other people who are proponents of literacy instruction are saying, no, early intervention is so important. And I sometimes wonder if it's because we don't know what we're talking about. Because when you say, I don't know what we're talking about, but we don't have this clear definition. So for example, if I were to say, we should be working on literacy in preschool, do I mean we're doing a worksheet and working on sight words, or do I mean something else? So if I mean something else, then that might be different. So I'm curious if you've seen that as well, or just some of those debates.
Well, right. I have heard of the debates, and I understand the frustration of parents and educators who feel that children should really go to kindergarten and preschool and have play experiences.
Yep.
So that play is so important.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we're not talking about taking away the play
right.
when we talk about emergent literacy and the skills. We're talking about games to play, stories to read, and engaging children, which is just a form of life, and language enriched activities that lay the groundwork for this emergent literacy. And so I think, as you say, that we get a little confused on the terms.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And there was a wonderful study done, if I can just kind of segue into this study. It was published in the Language, Speech, and Hearing Services in the Schools Journal early last year. And it was addressing teachers' use of scaffolds within conversations during story time. And again, we've got this word scaffold.
Yep. What do we mean by that? It means so many things.
Exactly. And you know, it reminds me of earlier this year, you know, I was in Greece. And I went, like all tourists do, I went and climbed up the Acropolis and photographed the Parthenon. And what you don't see, I mean, what you don't see in the travel photos is that the Parthenon is supported by this scaffolding. Mm-hmm. And it's beautiful. And I was just fascinated by it. I took my good camera and I took these pictures. I looked at this scaffolding and it's got levels. You know, first level, second level. And the Parthenon is just huge. It's just way up there in the sky. And I thought about the word scaffolding, and we use it all the time. What does it mean to parents? What does it mean to teachers that don't have the background in speech and language development? And, you know, it's a beautiful way to support kids. But in this article, back to the article, what they showed is that there was a real variance in the ability of the teachers to use these techniques with children.
I wanted to take a quick break here to talk about Language Therapy Advanced Foundations, my program that helps SLPs and other language and literacy professionals create a system for language intervention. As you are probably starting to realize based on our conversation, building the underlying language skills that kids need in order to support high-level comprehension, things like vocabulary, syntax, and semantics, is essential. And we can do some of that in the early years, but we need to continue building those skills throughout the school-age years. And certain students need more explicit instruction in these areas than others. And I give you a framework for doing that in the program. To learn more about how you can become a member, go to drkarenspeech.com/language therapy. One of the most frustrating things about educational technology is that there always seems to be a new trend that everyone's jumping on, which means that people get excited about a new tool, but then realize it's not aligned to teachers' or students' real needs. It helps to know that IXL is a tried and true product that's loved and trusted by more than 1 million teachers, allowing more time to focus on learning and providing real-time data, helping districts to provide equitable access to high-quality instruction. Studies across 45 states show that IXL schools outperform non-IXL schools on state assessments. Independent research from Johns Hopkins University verifies that IXL meets ESSA Tier 1 standards. With those results combined with IXL's teacher-friendly reputation, what more could you ask for? If you have a goal to increase achievement for all students, make sure to find out what IXL can do for you. Visit IXL.com/BE for a demo. That's IXL.com/BE. Now, let's get back to the conversation.
There's a couple of areas in this study. First of all, the study was limited, as studies are, to question and answers so that the teachers would respond to children's accurate responses and inaccurate responses. And of course, as speech pathologists, we don't do that. We're focused really on, you know, developing language expansion, that sort of thing. So it was within the context of language and question and answer that was, you know, either right or wrong. And from there, did the teacher use upward scaffolding or downward scaffolding? Okay, so let's look at scaffolding. Can we really discuss it? What does it mean? Yeah. And again, it's just so multifaceted. In what, like what you say, you know, about vocabulary and vocabulary meanings. Well, it's the same way with scaffolding. What do you do? So I like to put it in the framework of, again, literacy in the context of a story, reading a story. How do you interact and begin that scaffolding, that supporting, which is just like the scaffolding at the Parthenon? You're supporting this language development that's evolving. How do you do that? And it's so multifaceted. So, you know, you can start by reading a story, and you can start by saying, you mentioned trucks. Well, the little blue truck series, you know, you can talk about before you even start or even read the title. You can talk about what's your relationship with, you know, trucks? What are some other types of trucks? I mean, what do they do? You know, and get the background information so that they can start to relate a story with meaning. You know, the interrupting chicken books, you know, popping as a little chicken, you know, what do you think that the chicken's going to do? When you see the two reading and you know that the title is The Interrupting Chicken, and have you ever been interrupted? What does it feel like? And you get these conversations going at whatever level they can use their language at. And then, you know, what is the scaffolding that you use? Well, do you want to model what they say? Do you want to, if they're struggling with the sentence, do you want to say, you know, the little blue truck got stuck in the mud? And do you want to fill that out if they only give you a few words, or if they give an incorrect, you know, that sort of thing?
And expanding and extending on what they say.
Exactly. And there's another one, expanding, elaborating, and then providing, you know, closed sentences. So if children aren't really, you know, forming sentences, then, you know, give them the sentence and leave off the last word. It's beautiful when you're using a picture book because the picture's right there for them to fill in. So, you know, and then not only just eliciting picture descriptions, but really important, and I emphasize this throughout Books Are For Talking To with all of the books that I show how you can use them and give lesson plans for, you know, so many different uses in developing speech and language. Ask them to make predictions, point out the causal effects, you know, give them, you know, just make those connections for them so that then, and that's a form of scaffolding. It's a form of supporting child language when you can connect one word to the other or one event to the other, or you can predict based on, you know, what their experiences have been or what kind of little character it is, you know, the, if it's an interrupting chicken, what do you think that little chicken's going to do kind of thing. So again, scaffolding has so many facets to it. It's not just one thing, just like you were talking about with the vocabulary.
Yeah. I mean, I see it as there's a couple ways you can do it or ways you can look at it. Here's a task that the child might need some assistance in doing. And one way to scaffold would be give them assistance with the thing that you're having them do through modeling or providing some type of a cue in some way. Or you scaffold by changing what you present to them and maybe presenting an easier task versus a harder task and providing some structure with what the choice or the activity is. So I see those as two ways that we can scaffold, but I see it as context specific. Yes. Scaffolding, if you're talking about a book and you're wanting to build language and have a discussion as you're describing here, part of what you're doing when you're having those drawing inferences and predictions is I see it as we're modeling the internal thought processes that we should be having with ourselves as we're reading so that we can lay that foundation so that when kids get into kindergarten, first grade and do start to work with print directly, that they can have some of that foundation as well so that we are addressing the language and we are addressing some of those internal processes as well. And I think the modeling too, people don't realize how effective modeling can be and that we can model without the expectation of a specific response. Sometimes it's
very good
model, you know? So
very good. Oh, it reminds me of the time when I was working in the schools and a kindergarten teacher came in. And I was thrilled that she came in. I had a child who was in her classroom, and she said, he won't speak. He won't give me an answer. Like when it's story time. And I said, oh, give him the answer. And she looked at me like, are you kidding? And I said, it's not about giving you the right. He is either too shy or embarrassed to speak, or he had enough language that he could communicate with her, but he wasn't. And I said, just give him the words, model it. And as soon as I explained that modeling was just giving him the security and the words so that he could say them himself, then she was all right with it. But it's not always that you have to want the exact correct answer from a child.
Yeah.
It's not the content so often that you're looking for. It's really, you know, are they making connections in their own mind about, you know, logical for them, like, you know, the example of what you said about the child's dad was the car salesman or heavy equipment.
Yeah.
I just love that story.
Yeah. It was so funny because it was a well-known family because it was the car dealership in town. It was a small town. And it was like, oh, well, look who its dad is. That answer makes sense. And he was so proud and confident of that answer too, because he went to work with dad and that's what you do with cars. You sell them.
Of course. That was his experience, his background.
Yeah, exactly. And there's an opportunity to bridge and say, okay, and what do the people that you sell the cars to do with them afterwards?
Yeah,
there's an opportunity to bridge those two things together. With the modeling, I have found that even SLPs that go through some of my programs where with things like syntax, for example, that if a child does not have that form, they're not going to produce it. So if you're relying on things like expansions and extensions, when kids make an error, they're often not even attempting those forms because they don't have them yet. So you do have to use specific modeling, or even having them, you model and they repeat. That's one way. I think that people think if you tell them the answer, then you're giving them the answer, but that's not really true if they don't have the form yet. That is a form of scaffolding. And no, you don't want to only use that and have them always just do sentence repetition for your whole session, but that can be something that you work in to elicit a response. And people don't always realize that, because if you don't have it, then you actually are building some connections by practicing saying those sentences.
Exactly. Right. And that's the beauty of reading stories and getting the language in the story, because it's there, it's within the natural context, and they can just repeat the lines of the text. That's just the beauty of language, and that we can give them that and support them that way. Is lovely. It's just one more way you can give a child, you know, support in developing one of the components of language. There's so many, and that might be a obvious one, but others, like you say, making the connections and the predictions, those aren't as obvious, but you can point them out and have the child then show that there's understanding for that, and even craft sentences that connect, like, you know, just using the words and then in a sequence is an important step.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then using because this happened, you know, because, and in the story of the interrupting chicken, Papa fell asleep because he was tired of little chicken interrupting him. and little chicken was reading him a story, and that's what he was supposed to do. He was supposed to fall asleep with the story, as he wanted his little chicken to fall asleep. So just understanding, helping kids understand those concepts that may elude them, and just pointing things out, you know, is part of scaffolding, and it's so, you don't give scaffolding in just one area that's obvious, but in a lot of different areas when you interact with kids.
That example of because is a really good one, because if you have a child who's not connecting sentences, you can use that as a way to get them to expand. But also, complex sentences are one of the really common reasons that students struggle with comprehension as they get older, and it impacts executive functioning because they can't use those temporal and causal terms to engage in strategic thinking and self-talk. It impacts their reading comprehension. It impacts their writing and ability to form a cohesive narrative. And it's a vocabulary skill. People don't always think of syntax as a vocabulary skill. So if you can start embedding it in that early instruction, I see that as a really effective way you can work on syntax. I know that sometimes people think of complex sentences as a skill for older students, but you can integrate it way earlier. It's just, you're not expecting them to sit there and write paragraphs. You're embedding it the way that you just described.
Perfect. Absolutely. So
as we are discussing the nuance, I know that before there's the concern about, are we taking play away from early education? And no, if you are doing early literacy instruction in a way that is engaging and is working on the language skills, then it can be very play-based. But also at the same time, we're not talking about going too far in the other direction and working on some of these skills that maybe aren't as appropriate for a preschool setting. So I would love to hear your thoughts on just understanding the nuance of how do we build the language skills in a way that is appropriate for a preschool setting. I know even in some of the preschool curriculums, when I was working in the elementary school, they even said, we're not supposed to be working on print. It's those language skills that are going to support the print exposure when we get to it in kindergarten. So I'd love for you to talk through some of those things.
Oh, absolutely. So again, I guess what we want to think about, and it's so easy for parents and educators to think about reading as the printed word.
Mm-hmm.
And when we get rid of that, you know, alphabet letter, and mm-hmm. we talk about words and their sounds, then we can, you know, play games with those. So you can play games with the sounds and words. And so as you build on this skill, then you're building those building blocks for kids to then graft on those sound skills mm-hmm. to yep. the alphabetic principles, the written alphabetic letter.
Mm-hmm.
So without that, what you have is a reader who stumbles, and they stumble because they can't quickly use their phonetics, their phonological skills to sound out that word easily. They're stumbling because they don't have that sound symbol relationship. It wasn't embedded early. And again, I go back to that importance of building those skills in that hierarchy. So when you hear about a phonological awareness, you often hear people call it phonemic awareness. And for kids in preschool, it's really not phonemic awareness. We're not at the phoneme level yet. The phoneme being the isolated sound.
Mm-hmm.
We're still at the middle sound awareness. Can you tell me what middle sound is in the word spoon? Or if you're reading Goodnight Moon, or, you know, any kind of a children's book that has the sound element built into it, can you take those fun words and play a game with them and find those middle sound words? Or, you know, can you do onset rhyme? Can you roll it out? That's my name for the synthesis of phonemes. Can you roll that out? What are all the sounds in the word, sun? Roll it out. Roll it out, sun. Those are kinds of things that you can do during read aloud activities, and just take the word from the book that you're reading
mm-hmm.
and play with that word. And those are some of the things that preschoolers can do. So anyway, there's a whole sequence to it.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the fun kinds of things. And then as well, there's the whole building on the language. So building on vocabulary. I was using the book Little Blue Truck, and there's words in there like gravel and gallop, and there's the word friendliest, which has morphological features.
Mm-hmm.
There's curve and croak, and the toad's croak or the frog's croak, and there's great words that you could just play with and isolate them and talk about them and connect them to other things. And so within that, you're building those neural networks for, developing just not isolated words, but words in context. So it's just a great way to lay the foundations for reading. And that is emergent literacy, but it's not teaching reading necessarily. It's laying the foundation. So what I'm trying to get at is it's a fun activity for preschool and kindergarten, but you're really not forcing them if that's what the fear is. You're not forcing them to do something they're not ready to do, which is connect that sound symbol to the graphic symbol and start to read words and sight words and all of that. That may be later on. I just think that we should stay within the boundaries of what laying that emergency, that emergent literacy is all about. You know, the direction that words go, there's a lot of research now about, you know, showing them concepts of print and at story time, just they don't have to read, but you can follow the teacher's finger and show that that's a word. You've got a concept of print there. And so all these things aren't pushing children to read too early. So they're just the beginnings of how to lay the groundwork for the work to be done later on. And without that, you know, they're struggling.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what, you know, when you have these preschools, there's private preschools, and a lot of them are working on letters already and letter sounds in preschool, and parents love it. And the parents, and I know that some kids do fine with that if they are able to implicitly learn all of those skills that you said, if they have that solid language system to map those letters onto. And many times kids do fine if that's the case, but there are a lot of students who will be missed if we skip right to the letters. And I think that that is the way that we sometimes go too far in the other direction with sight words, where we're doing sight words and we're focused on the print symbols and we're not focused on the language at all. I think the big shift is about starting with language and mapping the orthographic symbols on top of that, in conjunction with that. And of course, that does become really important as you go through those elementary years, but not without the language as well. And especially not in the early years when they haven't had that exposure and built those skills to be able to associate those, the orthographic symbols with them.
Absolutely. And some kids can do that, and some kids will do that, and they'll move ahead, but not all kids will. And so, you know, for those kids that aren't, they're really lost.
Yeah.
They're just really lost because the class is moving ahead and they need that help at the early stages.
Are you familiar with Words Their Way?
Yeah, I've heard the term.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is one of those programs that kind of like what we were saying with whole language, where it is all of the things that you do with when you're discussing the topic and the vocabulary makes sense if you have the phonological component and the phonics component. And this is for older kids as well. As long as you have those structural components, then yes, it's great to talk about comprehension. But with Words Their Way, a lot of times the way that it's implemented is that kids are sitting there with print symbols, sorting and playing with words with the print symbols. And it's supposed to be, for some kids, a spelling intervention. But if you need a spelling intervention, chances are just looking at print symbols without vocalizing and pairing it with language is not going to be helpful. And so it's one of those things where potentially it could be used in a way that's useful, but it's often not, because a lot of times, because teachers are busy, it's, we're going to go in stations and I'm going to put you over here and do your Words Their Way lesson. And you're just sorting words without using the language and without somebody modeling, and not so super helpful. But if you were to take those same materials and then pair them with language and vocalize and do that while you're using it, it could be useful. So it's one of those almost but not quite kind of a things that happens sometimes.
But what I love about Words Their Way is that the physical part of it, if mm-hmm. they're manipulating, it's active reading is another one that gets kids involved in hand signals and anything that they can do gross motor to tie in with, you know, the reading aspect is really helpful for some kids. I've seen it be just kind of miraculously work for some kids. And so that's important too. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, you don't want to leave a few behind.
Right.
Those few behind are the ones that may need that very important phonological piece, that sound system, in order to, as you say, map or graft onto those symbols, you know, that they're moving around in their work. And if they don't, like you say, if they don't have the teacher guidance, that's one thing about the speech pathologist who can sit there with, you know, just a few kids, but mm-hmm. teachers have so many
yep.
kids, you know, are they going to be able to, you know, be at all tables at all times? No. And so, you know, these reading programs have so many wonderful features, but learners just are so diverse. But what we do know about all of them is that they have to start with that phonological base, that awareness yeah. of sound and the sounds, this not just sound, but speech sounds.
Mm-hmm. Always tell people, just because you didn't teach it directly to a student and you don't see them processing that doesn't mean that they aren't using it. A lot of times people just assume, well, yeah. they just went right to the print symbol. No, they didn't. In their head, they right. did all of this. You just didn't see it because that student happened to catch on to that implicitly. These other students who are drilling these sight words and never remembering them need you to break it down explicitly. In all of these programs that are ineffective, there's always a piece of it where if it was implemented a little bit differently yes. in conjunction with these other effective methods and pulled in, it would make sense. And that's why they caught on and stayed around so long, because they sound logical. It yes. sounds logical to one thing that I repeat this all the time, but context clues. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. appropriate if it's an older student who wants to build their vocabulary and use the context of the text to learn more information about yes. the word. It's not effective when you don't know how to decode the word. It's not going to help you to figure that out, because chances are there's too much cognitive load. And if you don't have a strategy to be able to, you know, do word attack, then you're not going to be able to use the context. So yeah, it's all about understanding the right features and putting them in the right place.
Well, that reminds me also of drawing inferences. And so many times we read a story to a child and we can draw the inference. We think it's normal and logical that anyone would draw the inference to understand. But sometimes children don't have that ability to, they don't have the background information, or they can't make that link to mm-hmm. draw that inference. And so, as you said, when we were talking about, you know, earlier on establishing the connections, that's another example of how those connections can be missed unless you really focus on them, identify them, and point them out to children. See if they're making those connections. See if they can draw those inferences. And if they can't, it's a wonderful way to scaffold, is to help them get their background knowledge working for them. Connect that background knowledge to whatever it is that you're trying to, you know, infer information from, and then, you know, help them that way. So mm-hmm. it's another way of what you're saying is we don't see these things, you know, they just happen quickly.
For us, because they're automatic. Yeah.
Exactly.
Inferencing is a great one, because that's another one where you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's an important skill, but I see a lot of SLPs working on inferences. I would say other professionals as well, where students are not drawing inferences on texts, and it's because they don't have the decoding skills and they're so bogged down with trying to decode the words that they don't yes. have any bandwidth left for inferencing, or yes. they don't have the background knowledge and the vocabulary or the syntax skills. So there's so much
of it's a cognitive load issue. They don't have anything left for inferencing. Exactly. So yes, you don't want to stop working on inferencing in other situations and modeling that skill, but you need to build those foundational skills so that they can actually benefit from this work on inferencing.
Exactly. Yeah. And so much time is in focus is on the sounding out and just trying to say the word that they're missing. But that's when they're reading, when you're reading even a story to them, are they making the inferences? And so often we read a story and we think that that is so easy to understand because of our background knowledge. It's just like instant. But for kids, sometimes they don't have that background knowledge and they are lost. Mm-hmm. And even the older kids, you know, not high, well, all kids, but I'm thinking about, you know, fourth graders when they, mm-hmm. when they're starting to read these chapter books and you're working with them on comprehension. Sometimes, you know, it eludes you why they're stuck until you realize it's this small inference that we think people understand and know and it eludes the child.
Mm-hmm. I know.
I think that one of the important features to remember in all of this, and of course, my book is on interacting with children and using picture books as a way to improve, you know, reading, but language, it's all tied together. But I guess the main focus here that I want to say is that it's not always about the right and wrong answer. It's about making connections, learning new words. It's about the experience, and it's not about what is this called? Mm-hmm. name this item in the picture.
Yeah. It's not a quiz.
No, it's not. It's not about coming up with the right answer. It's really about establishing conversation. It's about needing those conversational skills. And so often kids just get bombarded with these questions. Mm-hmm. During this interactive period, and they may have a different background. They might have a different cultural background. They might be embarrassed about, you know, they already go to speech class. They might be embarrassed to speak. They're too, you know, they're not sure of themselves. So giving the answer is an important, supporting them with that beautiful scaffolding that I was talking about that I saw, and now I have a beautiful image for scaffolding since my trip, but mm-hmm. that all that that we can give them, and it's just not about for us as speech pathologists and for parents and for teachers that are, you know, sharing a piece of literature. It's not about the right answer. It's really about helping them make connections, learn new words, and understand what they're reading.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, where can people connect with you or learn more about your work?
Well, I do have, of course, I've mentioned my book, Books Are for Talking To, and it's now in its fourth edition. Mm-hmm. It's was just published this year in its fourth edition. But I also have a website called soundingyourbest.com. And on my website, I have a section called Book Talk. And what I do is I feature one book per month. So this November is Native American Heritage Month, for example. So this month, it's called Still This Love Goes On that I'm featuring. And it's a book, picture book. Written by Buffy St. Marie, which if you don't know, she was a longtime folk singer and born in the Cree Nation, but adopted I think Connecticut. But I go through these picture books, and it's very similar to how I feature books in Books Are for Talking To. What kind of skills can you work on with this book? And what are the methods, and how can you, you know, draw these methods out? And then there's sort of actionable tips. So they can find those sorts of things on my website, and you can contact me at Jane@soundingyourbest.com. And Yeah, I hope you visit the site every month. The last month in October, it was Room on the Broom, if you know that one, by Julia, I think her name is Shirtle, but great book for Halloween.
I know that people who are listening are always looking for good books that they can use with their clients, or books that are readily available that they can share with clients in a place that they can go to help their clients to understand, or the families to know what they should be doing at home. Because I always get questions about what things can I be recommending to the parents of my students. So this would be a good resource to share with parents and families as well. So not just for your sessions, but also for the people you work with, so that you can help them to do some of these things at home.
And most of these books are books that are readily available in school and public libraries. So I try to make all the books in Books If We're Talking To, and I've listed, I think, 260, have detailed lesson plans on, you know, how to use these books for whatever, you know, skills you're working on. But these books should be readily available in your library. So there wouldn't be anything to buy. You just visit your library. And sometimes it's easy, especially for speech therapists. You know, I remember working, you know, at all the schools and just popping in at the library just to find new ones. And it's a great way. It's a great resource, just a wonderful resource. So.
And Books Are For Talking is all of the things that you outlined today. A lot of the phonological awareness activities are described in that book. So if people want more context and explanation or examples, they can get the book and use it for talking about lots of other books, right?
Right. And there's also a skills or a topic section. So there's topic exploration, and there's almost 100 topics that are listed. And if you are really working on language and you want to extend whatever you learned in one book to another book because it's on the same topic. That's a good one. Then you've got, I think I've listed, I don't know how many topics in that book, but we've got careers and alphabet books and, you know, kindness and empathy, books on horses that are, you know, now with equine therapy, there are a lot of children on the spectrum who are getting the equine therapy and they love the horses. And so there's a section on horses and folklore, Native American folklore, like for the month of November. And there's all kinds of topics for pragmatic usage. It's nice. And just for language development, it's nice to be able to use more than one resource in topic related, because the language, you can use more vocabulary. You can just do more with a series on a topic than just one book after the other. So that's as well.
Well, thank you so much for being here with me today.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to check the show notes for all of the fantastic resources that were mentioned in this conversation, including where you can go to connect with Jane and learn more about some of the resources and tools she provides to assist both professionals and parents with scaffolding during book reading and other language-based activities. Also, if you are a language and literacy professional and you want a framework for language intervention, check out Language Therapy Advanced Foundations. You can learn more about the program at drkarenspeech.com/language therapy. And if you are a related service provider that wants to get your team on board with supporting students' executive functioning across the day, check out the School of Clinical Leadership. This program will help you plan direct therapy, but will also help you lead change management on your team, no matter your job title. You can learn more about the School of Clinical Leadership at drkarendudekbrandon.com/clinical leadership. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave me a rating and review wherever you listen to your podcasts, and feel free to share it with your friends and colleagues. If you have a suggestion for a guest, or if you're interested in being a guest on the De Facto Leaders podcast, please email me at drkarenspeech.com. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I will see you next time. Do you want to simplify your school's technology, save teachers time, improve students' performance on state assessments without just teaching to the test? You can do it all, but don't waste another minute. Head straight to IXL.com/BE to learn how IXL's research-based teaching and learning platform can help you achieve all these goals. That's IXL.com/BE.